Welcome to another episode of Outside the Valley, a podcast by ARC, the remote hiring platform that helps you hire remote software engineer and teams easily. Here we interview remote startup leaders, remote work advocates, and remote workers of distributed teams who thrive outside of Silicon Valley. I'm your host, Jovian Gautama. Our guest today is the remote work consultant and strategist. She's the CEO of Distribute Consulting and the founder of the Remote Work Association. Her writing about remote work, impacts of virtual jobs, management, and human resources are also routinely featured on Forbes. If you want to know anything about the future of work, not only on the individual level, but also on the organizational level and social level, she's definitely the expert. So very pleased to be joined by Laurel Farrer. Laurel, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So just today, I was re-listening to a podcast, like Joe Rogan podcast. It's very cliche. And with the Naval Ravikant, the founder of AngelList. And there's one point where they're talking about that the argument is that there will be new jobs in the future. Like 10 years ago, you cannot imagine the jobs that we have now. Like 10 years ago, if you're talking like podcasts, there will be a podcaster. There will be a podcast host and podcast producer. Or if there will be a remote work consultant, people will think like, are you crazy? Like, so I just find it like an interesting thing that because it keeps evolving. And remote work consultants is really something that's, I feel like it's so unique. So just to kick things off, let's start a bit, can you share a bit more about yourself and how did you came into like making remote work your thing, like contribute more to the whole ecosystem, so to speak?
Yeah. Well, I have been a remote worker myself for about 13 years now, and I took my own team remote as an operations manager at that time. And that's when I really saw the benefits for the organization, like you mentioned. And so I was seeing high productivity, higher talent acquisition, higher retention, lower costs, you know, all of these benefits. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, fantastic. But I naively assumed that, you know, it was a very organic thing. Everybody was seeing the same benefits as I was. And so companies started asking me questions. And so I would help them in the off season of my job. And it all just evolved very organically until I worked as the CEO of a fully distributed company of about 500. And when I was there, it was an extremely toxic environment at the executive level. And that's when I saw that there was a right way to do remote work and a wrong way. And that was also the time that IBM and Yahoo were retracting their policies. And I'm an organizational development nerd. And so I said, we really have to figure out exactly what the X factors are here that will put you on the right path or the wrong path so that we as organizational leaders can make those intentional changes in our workforce. And so that's how Distribute Consulting started, just identifying that remote work is very easy to fall into, but just because it's happening doesn't mean that you're doing it well. And so that's why Distribute exists, is to make remote work and virtual jobs and digital infrastructures better, not just to build them, but to help our businesses leverage this as a strategy.
It's funny you mentioned like on your previous client, like the toxic environment is from the executive, mm-hmm. right? So how would you change that? Because I feel like if the toxic environment is, you know, on the employee level, so to speak, it's kind of like, it's like an top to bottom approach, right? The executive, mm-hmm. hey, do this. But if the toxic environment is on the executive level, right? So which means you need to change the mind of the executive, right? Like, just curious, like how did you, I feel like it's a broad question, but how did you do it? Like, what are the two or three most important things that you did to change this mindset?
Yeah, well, remote work isn't unique in this space, right? Like any company can have a bad culture and a toxic culture. Yeah. But it comes to light a little bit more because there's this great debate of what actually fuels productivity the most. Is it good leadership or is it flexibility? And thankfully, Gallup did a great, great study on this that says, well, it's actually both. When you offer great leadership and flexibility, that's when you see the optimal results. You're going to see results from both individually, but when you combine them, that's when you're going to see the maximum optimization of your workforce. And so that's exactly what we do, is we say, look, let's implement these virtual workflows and protocols, write policies that will help people stay safe, all of that kind of stuff. But then also let's get training for your management that will help them understand how to engage in this virtual space. So if I boiled it down to three things to answer your question, the first thing that I always do is make sure that the company is compliant. So we write a remote work policy to make sure that those employees don't feel scared about losing their flexibility. That's very, very common right now, because most remote work arrangements are happening on an individual level. Like, yes, you can work from home because, you know, your husband is deployed or something like that. Right. So it's an individual thing. So we make sure that there's a standard policy to make sure that it's non-discriminatory, it's fair, it's accessible, and it's safe. That way they can feel more safe in their role. So we make the workforce compliant in that way. Then we also provide training for the management and for the workforce. Everybody needs to understand how collaboration in a virtual environment is different. It's not a big difference, but it is a very significant difference, and you don't know what you don't know. And so if you fall into this, then it's like, oh yeah, like, why would I need to have more transparent communication? Like, what is that a thing? And we say, yeah, it's actually a really big thing. So we get them policies, we get them training. And then also just really calculating the return of this change. Hmm. A lot of people are not understanding how impactful this is to their productivity. And so they, because of that, they're not valuing remote work and flexibility policies as much as they should. And they think that it's insignificant. So therefore, that's why we see policy retractions, right? Like, oh, it's not a big deal. Bring everybody back into the office, because they haven't accurately calculated how much this is benefiting their organization, right? How much real estate savings, how much productivity costs are being saved, all of that. And so when we actually show them a number and say, look, this is how much it's boosting your bottom line, suddenly it's something worth preserving and leveraging a lot more.
What you say just now are super interesting. Like, I like that you start with compliance first, because, you know, when we're talking about remote work, right? People always talk about, you know, productivity, high retention, but are you compliant? Like, this is the unsexy part of it. So when I was doing research,
that's what I specialize in, the unsexy side of
so work. When I was doing the research for this interview, you wrote an article, I think it's Forbes, like, is remote work illegal? Yeah. And then I was like, oh yeah, is it illegal? Like, I haven't even clicked into it. Like, yeah, so this is something that people kind of forget. And, you know, there are thought leaders everywhere, but I can't find like compliance thought leaders, especially when it comes to, like, you have distributed teams all around the world, then it gets even more tricky.
It's a massive problem.
Right. You feel like this is still a massive problem. I know that we have like a lot of some startups or services that, you know, kind of like helping on that, but do you still feel like this is like a super huge problem?
Absolutely. Yeah. The number one problem that those startups are dealing with is just HR compliance and making sure that employment laws are being met in every single region in which you have employees, and making sure that taxation is covered. So that's a very complex logistical problem, but that's only one of the compliance issues that we're seeing. What most remote workers don't understand is that how much work goes into creating a safe, compliant environment in an office. There are days and days and millions of dollars that go into information security, workplace design, ergonomics, like OSHA standards. Like, there are so many things that go into play that the workers and the, you know, direct workforce, boots on the ground, they never know about. They just come into the workplace, sit down, and start working. And so when you ignore all of that investment in safety and security and compliance, and you just start working off site, it's all illegal. You're breaking about 15 to 20 different laws just by going on offsite if you don't update it correctly. So yeah, it's really critical that we, number one, update our policies and our infrastructures, like I said, to in order to recognize and fill in the gap of that compliance, but then also to inform our remote workers. Like if we just consider health and safety standards for just a second, this was a big problem back in the 40s, 50s, 60s. People were getting carpal tunnel syndrome, right? Because of the ergonomics of an office were not enforced. Then we did all of this research and figured out exactly what makes, you know, what makes a sustainable, safe environment. And so there are, I mean, hundreds of items on a checklist that a health and safety compliance officer has to come into a workplace and check off and say, yes, there are no tripping hazards. The temperature is set at these degrees. There is this amount of lighting. There is this amount of space between the keyboard and the screen. Like all of these tiny little things that you don't think about that actually keep you safe. And because you don't know about that, again, you don't know what you don't know. And so when you go offsite, you don't know that you should be enforcing all of those things in order to keep you safe in the long term. So we're seeing like this step back 50, 60 years in history in terms of workforce safety and health.
Yeah.
And that's just one.
Right. Also, there are other, I've seen a case where basically, I think Josh Pickford from Bear Metrics, like they're fully remote team, right? Mm-hmm. And so basically, I think he didn't realize there's an obscure tax law in one of the states that his team members are in, and they have to pay like a couple of thousand dollars just out of the blue. So that's kind of sucks, again, if you're an executive, right?
And if you don't know about it. Like
it's,
you don't know what you don't know. So it's so critical to work with a remote work consultant, not as a personal plug, but as somebody that is on the other side of this that does know what you don't know, so that you can make this transition and say, oh, wow, I was about to break all of these laws that I wouldn't know about until a lawsuit was going to be filed against me. Like I need to make sure that I am preventing those risks instead of trying to clean up the mess.
Yeah, that is super interesting. You also mentioned about calculating or measuring the impact of going remote, like transitioning from co-located to distributed. How do you define the metrics, or do you have the same metrics for every companies you work with? Is it like revenue, or how do you decide that?
Yeah, there's a lot of criteria that we do measure across the board. We do customize it for each of our clients, depending on exactly which metrics they're looking to pull and which ones they want to promote. But in general, just about every single company is going to see impact in a variety of places. One is real estate, obviously. Another is the net ratio of the employees, meaning, and there's a lot of different ripple effects there, right? Like locality costs and just income to expenses ratio for the individual. They don't have to spend as much on going to work, and therefore maybe you don't need to pay them as much. So that's an issue. We also see productivity costs are actually the number one place where most companies see the greatest savings, because people are just more productive. They're giving more output. And so your systems are just automatically more efficient.
Yeah, how do you measure productivity costs?
That's a good question. So this is where it gets very complicated. And then, in fact, I loop in experts like Global Workplace Analytics. Her name is Kate Lister. She is my go-to for that.
I see.
But yes, we do measure results. And this is where the organizational development piece comes into play. But just about every operations manager is tracking the production costs of your product or service, right? How many hours it takes, how many people, all of that life cycle of what it takes to produce one product or one service. And then the more that you make that efficient, the cheaper the cost per product is. And so if you can make that more efficient, then it goes down and down and down. And that's where we see the productivity costs in distributed teams.
But I feel like I feel like there's a lot of like handholding. If you work with a company, right? Okay, we want to help you transition from co-located to distributed. And basically you also need to figure out like your clients need to figure out like do they even know like the cost to make their product, especially when it's software, right? The thing with software is just it's all out there. It's a time. There's no like raw materials out there. So I think it's really interesting because like I always had the theory that if your company wants to go remote, it's good because it pushes you to get your shit together. Like, you know, yeah. Like basically the documentation, the culture, like figuring out the policy, something like that. So that's kind of like, like if you're like, you know, startups, like if you're a software startup, you're like all over the place, you're really forced to, you know, get your shit together, man. Like it's there. And I think remote consultants like you kind of like help like push in that way, because if you think about it, at the end of the day, you will know the real cost of shipping a particular piece of a software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's a lot of what we do, especially with, like you said, the startups, the small businesses. In fact, we collaborate with VCs on exactly that, making sure that the infrastructure of the building of the businesses that they're building are sound, that there are not long-term risks associated with building a fully distributed team. So we make sure that they have those communication channels in place, the digital resources, that there's that culture of trust being built right from the very beginning. Because, I mean, you've worked in startup, I worked in startup, and 9 times out of 10, it's not the product that fails, it's the team. And if the team isn't set up with a good virtual workplace, then yeah, of course they're going to fail. So yeah, we really make sure that we build that virtual office, if you will, space for them so that they, and give them the leadership training and then hand the ball to them on doing the rest.
Yeah. You're talking about, you know, regarding building startups or business and remote work, like I mentioned to you before the call, I'm really curious about the topic of, you know, the social and community aspect of a distributed work, remote work, whatever you call it, virtual jobs. So there's this one article you wrote, which mentioned about remote work encourages entrepreneurship. I totally agree with it. And I feel like this is something that's, I feel like rarely mentioned because people like kind of take it for granted, but they don't really realize it because remote work enables it. So for example, my favorite example is actually indie hackers. Like the ability for you to connect with other people around the world, it just makes it easier for you to, to create stuff, to create something valuable. And you don't have to be in Silicon Valley to make great connections and even to start a startup, which is why this podcast is called Outside the Valley, because we think that you can just build great teams everywhere, right? Also, the fact that a lot of VCs now, venture capitalists, backs remote startups, Andreas Klinger just launched the Remote First Capital thing that backs remote companies, which I found super interesting. Yeah, I just don't feel like this is talking about the entrepreneurship part. This one, the one thing that I want to ask you is about remote work strength is the local technology culture. You also write about this. Can you elaborate a bit more about that?
Yeah, so are you talking in relationship to communities or businesses?
More like the community, I think. Community,
okay. Yeah, so communities, this is a really big conversation that's happening. A lot of the government projects that I work on are related to this. Mm-hmm. How can communities and, you know, cities, counties, governments, people, residents, how can they benefit from having remote workers in their area? And it's a really, really fascinating conversation because just like we are dispersing workers, we're also dispersing business and business opportunities like you talked about. But what's happening above that is that we're also dispersing industry and we're also dispersing opportunity. So this means, yes, you don't have to commute to your office in, you know, downtown Chicago or Hong Kong or whatever, but that also means that you don't have to leave your tiny little town who is dependent on your tax revenue. It also means that you can bring your industry, whatever it is, healthcare or manufacturing or entertainment or design, you can bring that also to your tiny little town that never would have been able to recruit a large healthcare company into their city, you can bring your company with you and bring the impact of that company right into your town. So we're seeing amazing, massive results with this, that we are really distributing wealth and opportunity all throughout the urban-rural divide, and really alleviating the hyper-urbanization problems that are happening right in metro areas, but then also in so doing, stimulating rural areas and equating opportunity in both.
Yeah, I totally found this super interesting. So I also found, I look at your LinkedIn, so you were a strategist as on the Utah's rural online initiative, right? Mm-hmm. Can you share a bit more, like, how did you exactly help the government on that role?
Yeah, I was actually connected to this opportunity by a friend. I'm originally from Utah. And so a friend said, oh, there's something remote work related happening in Utah. You must be involved. And I said, no, I'm not, but let me reach out to them. So I connected with them and said, hey, if there's anything I can do to help, let me know. And they said, I'm so glad you called, because we didn't think this bill would pass, and here we are. We don't know what to do. We're supposed to take remote jobs into rural Utah. What's next? And I said, oh, this is perfect.
That's so government, you know? Like, I didn't think this bill will pass. Like, oh, yeah, crap, what do we do?
we don't know what we're going to do. Yeah, and I mean, to their credit, they had great ideas, great vision. And then my team and I just came in and we said, okay, let's design the curriculum. So, and the entire infrastructure. And so essentially we built this distributed company, a distributed organization and program that teaches other people how to be distributed. So our program takes a rural resident that has never heard about remote work before, all the way through the phases of training and job coaching and job acquisition, and gets them a remote job at the end. And then that's just the worker side. We also now have a business side in which we do the same thing with businesses. We take them from being, you know, very hesitant about remote work, teaching them what the benefits of virtual workers are, help them convert their operations in order to support virtual workers, and then hire the virtual workers that we've just trained. And so they get connected together at the end. We're seeing enormous success with the program, and it's now scaling nationally throughout the United States.
Was it, were you limited by the industry? Like, no. I think a lot of people, oh, that's interesting. But I think a lot of people's minds, like, oh, remote work, like, what if you were in a farm, for example, or in like, or things that you don't associate with, you can work from home. So yeah, can you share a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I get pretty defensive when a lot of the great remote work ideas are only limited to tech, right?
Like, exactly.
Oh, we're just going to do tech jobs. And I'm like, no, I'm personally frustrated about that, because I don't come from tech. And so a lot of the remote work knowledge, I shared at the beginning that I thought, oh, I'm sure everybody knows what I'm doing, because I didn't know that nobody else knew this. And so when I got connected with the tech industry, I was so mad. I was like, you guys have such great information. You've got to share this with the other industries. And so that was really how my business started, was like connecting the dots and saying, okay, Automattic, you talk to Buffer and Envision, you talk to Cigna, like, let's talk to each other about what we're doing and not doing. And that was a lot of my research is identifying that. So yes, I'm going to use a strong word. It's very selfish of tech to think that remote work is only happening in their companies. It's happening everywhere. We're seeing amazing growth rates in healthcare, in financial services, in entertainment. It's immense. But then specifically in reference to the rural conversation, yes, we have amazing amounts of people that are losing their livelihoods because their manufacturing jobs have shut down, right? This is why we have an entire third of the United States that's called the Rust Belt, because it's just deteriorating. And we see, you know, 30 to 60% unemployment rates. I mean, that's completely unacceptable. So this can help. And that's exactly what we try to do with the Rural Online Initiative, is help them convert their skills from tactical jobs like manufacturing. We work with coal miners. We work with even like stay-at-home parents. We say, okay, what skills have you used in your roles in the past? And let's adapt those and find freelancing roles or find full-time employment roles that capitalize on those skills. I think that's, I mean, that's the premise of the gig economy in general, right? It's like freelancers specialize in a niche. And so that really opens employment opportunities to people that have a niche. Like if we say, yeah, you were on a factory line all day, every day for the past 20 years, that's hard to convert that to remote work. Yeah. However, when we zoom into the bullet points of their job description and we say, you're fantastic at workflow management, you led a team, you understand development processes and protocols, then all of a sudden that translates much more easily into the virtual world.
Oh, this is fascinating. This is the first time I've heard about this. Like, okay, but can you give me an example? Like, how does it convert? Like you mentioned someone that worked in a factory line, and then what job can she got? Like, what remote job can she got?
Yeah. So, I mean, just think about just leadership skills, right? So let's imagine somebody was on a factory management line. And so they led a team of people that, you know, somebody was at station A, somebody was at station B, somebody was at station C. Mm-hmm. And they were, you know, sewing backpacks or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. If we just take away that phrase of sewing backpacks, and we turn that into somebody at station A, somebody at station B, and somebody at station C is designing a website, it's exactly the same process. Project management is project management. It's just the product and the service that's different. And so we can say, and especially the role of the Rural Online Initiative is to help people open their mind to that, because the employers are saying, you worked in a factory, like you have nothing to do with my business. And we're saying, no, zoom in, look at that project management. And then all of a sudden when you do that and you say, this person knows how to lead people, they know how to create a workflow, they know how to pass responsibility off from one person to another, they know how to conduct performance reviews, all of that. Then all of a sudden what happens is that when you offer that to an employer, you say, look, now who's your competition? You have somebody that's been doing project management for 2 years, they're fresh out of college, they've never worked in an office environment with other people, or you have this person from a rural county that has project management experience for the past 35 years. Like, now what's more valuable? So it's a translation, right? Like, it's like we were talking about in the beginning, that a company needs to go through this process of shifting their mindset from physical to virtual. This is kind of just the core of the problem of the future of work in general, that we're just so limited in our mindsets and our perspectives that one thing is done a certain way. But when we open our minds to that and help translate the entire business world from physical to virtual, it really helps bridge the gap and make the transition much smoother.
Wow, this is absolutely great. And also, in coincidence, I mentioned in the beginning, like I was listening to the Joe Rogan's podcast with Naval Ravikant, right? And Naval made an exactly the same argument about retraining people.
Yes.
So like, people can be retrained in the adult. Like, why should we only stick, you know, the traditional education? You know, you go to school, you go to college, and so on. So yeah, it's also funny, like you mentioned, like tech people are selfish. I feel like tech people, like us, like kind of like living in a bubble sometimes. It's also funny because a lot of principles, like I'm not sure if it's a lot, some principles are taken from the traditional supply chain, like the Toyota way is a really famous when it comes to project management, product management, and so on. So it's like comes for a circle.
In fact, I just had a long conversation with my Uber driver actually a few weeks ago, that I was on a business trip and he was talking about how he had been unemployed for a year and a half and he had been doing very, very, very well. And then his business just shut down because it was a trucking brokerage. And so he's like, yeah, like it's just my industry is gone. And so we kept talking and I said, well, what about artificial intelligence? Like, I know that there's a lot of AI tools and software and processes that are being developed for shipments, right? For all of this transportation infrastructure of goods. Like, it's not that your job went away. It's just that the knowledge is shifting. And he said, oh yeah, well, actually there was these three really large companies that came and studied my business for a year and in order to build those products. And I was like, there's your job, man. So I said, today, absolutely right after this drive, like turn your sign off and go contact those companies, because the knowledge still is needed. The role is shifting and how we're using the knowledge is different, but those workflows are just being adapted to new processes. And so it is so critical that we utilize all of the experience and intellectual property that was built over generations of industries and just use it for in a new way, as opposed to drawing this big line between, although that's the old way of doing things and there's this new way of doing things. In fact, and I love my technology friends so much, right? All of these distributed companies, they're so great. But this is a lot of work that I have to do, is saying with these distributed companies that are saying, oh, you know, I wish that there was some way that we could like really encourage our workers to be better. And we're noticing that we have a lot of career stagnancy rates. Like, oh, what do we do? And I'm like, okay. Look, I know that you guys are like completely anti-enterprise and, you know, the big brands are the big bad wolf. I get that. But guess what? They have hundreds of years of workforce development, and they are actually required to have learning and development departments for this reason. Did you guys know that learning and development departments exist? And they were like, no, but that would solve all of our problems. I'm like, yeah, we don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time. We just have to think of information in a new way. So yeah, whether it be with the workforce or the business, we really need to start bridging the gap and stop thinking that remote work is a new type of work. Right. It's not. It's just work. Like, we're just doing it in a new location.
I think this also drives a point when it comes to remote hiring, especially when you're tech startups, right? So like you mentioned, I think there's a lot of skills. Like, I feel like there's tendency for, you know, tech startups, they want to hire people who have experience in tech startups before, mm-hmm. right? But I think when you go, like, you look through that, there's actually a lot of talent that can learn pretty quickly once you get thrown into an environment. And if you have a great company culture to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, like you mentioned, those factory workers that have been working in the factory like 10, 15 years, he or she is probably a good project manager. And if tech startups can somehow tap that talent, like they can find a way to, hey, this person is actually a good project manager. And we know at this point, if you're remote startups, then distance doesn't matter anymore, right? You can be mm-hmm. Silicon Valley and your team members can be in Utah or Birmingham, Alabama. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. So I think because as for software engineers, I think it's easier, right? You can, you know, if you're good enough, you can create something, you can, you know, self-learn stuff. And the test is kind of like, startups are good at finding software engineers at testing. But when it comes to marketing or sales, I feel like it's really hard for non-tech people. Like I personally, here is my first tech startup job. Before, I was like in a very traditional industry. I was selling mm-hmm. steels to customers abroad.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of like lucky that CodeMentor and Arc, they kind of like see, oh, this guy can kind of learn the mm-hmm. thing in tech startups. So yeah.
And when they are willing to open their mind like that, that's what really opens up the great opportunity.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, too many business leaders of all industries and all company sizes are very limited and very entitled. And they say, well, no, you work with me and this is what I have to offer. And that's the end of the story. So if you don't like it, then you must be a bad match for us. And it's very easy to fall into that mentality. I mean, I certainly have as well. But when we open up our minds even further and we say, man, I have a high turnover rate in my business. This is a problem. And man, instead of thinking like, well, it's the problem of the workers, take a step back and say, yeah, actually it might really help to have workers with more experience and more dedication and loyalty maybe from the baby boomer generation. Hmm. And then, you know, and then, but then even take it a step further and say, well, instead of just recruiting and tapping that talent pool, maybe we take a step back and say, have a conversation with that demographic and say, what do you need? Like, why is this job not appealing to you? Because I need you. So what can I do for you in order to make this job more appealing? Because you are bringing a lot of wealth and knowledge and experience into this role. And I want to make sure that that it's something that you're excited about. And then, you know, that's where you start getting more information of like, well, I'm not 50 years away from retirement. I'm 15 years away from retirement. I need to have a really good retirement package. And sometimes it's that simple. And they're like, oh, well, then yeah, I can do that, you know? So it's just a matter of talking and conversing and really opening up your mind.
Yep.
And not just falling into that trap of like, yeah, our company is so cool. It's a privilege to work for us, and that should be good enough for you.
Yeah, I also just realized when it comes to remote real a company always talking, oh, remote work is good because you are tapping into the talent all over the world, which is correct in a way. But I think when they say that in their minds, like tech talents all over the world. But when remote work got more and more popular, you can see these, I'll say, undeveloped talent that actually yes, pretty good, right? And then they can learn to be in tech, and then your talent pool opens up even much, much larger.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, if we're honest with ourselves, recruiting, it's just marketing. It's marketing your company.
Yep.
And so if we think about it in the same terms as marketing your business, you would never, ever just open up your business and say, we're going to sell to every single human being on the planet. Like, that doesn't make any sense. The first step that every marketing director and sales manager does is create a consumer profile. Like, who are we selling to? Because they are going to be more likely to buy our product and boost our business than somebody, you know, some random person next to them. And so that's who we're going to target. And we get very, very specific about the skills and qualities and traits and locations that we want our consumers to have. Yet we're not applying that at all to our recruiting, especially when we open up our recruiting to be virtual and we're saying, yeah, anybody from anywhere can work for us. And it's like, how is that going to benefit your business? No, zoom in, create a candidate profile and say, people living in this location, maybe of this age demographic, people that have experience in a variety of industries, this is what's going to be uniquely beneficial to our workflows and processes. That's who we want to target. So it's not a matter of like hiring from anywhere. It's strategizing and leveraging the fact that you can hire from anywhere to create an even wider talent pool in which you can then narrow back in. Everybody's thinking really big right now, but we got to zoom back in.
Got it. Right. Also want to talk a bit more about distributed teams or remote work on the leadership level. I think you mentioned about on one of your articles is about the self-discipline, right? You have, as a remote worker, you have to hone your self-discipline. But I was thinking about if a company is transitioning from co-located to distributed, right? Which means, I believe if this happens, I mean, they have a certain trust with their employees that you are self-disciplined. Mm-hmm. But I still feel it's still a challenge, right? You know, so you procrastinate, especially when it comes new hires, like older employees, they kind of know how it's going. They have a report with the executives and they want to do their best job. But for new hires, especially when they're their first remote job, they probably need some hand-holding, so to speak. So how can a company help hone one's self-discipline? Like how can a company help a new remote hire, or not necessarily new, just a remote team member to be more productive, but not in a micromanaging way?
Yeah, there is, it's really critical to understand that when you are offsite, more self-management is required. And so that's the mistake that most people think is that, oh, I'm going to start working offsite, everything's going to be the same, and it's just going to be more convenient for me. And it's like, no, look, there are so many management benefits that come from working in a co-located environment. Even if you have a bad manager, there are a lot of management benefits. Somebody's always watching you. You're feeling motivated, right? There's people that are next to you to just to kind of feel the energy of the day.
Vibe,
and flows. Yeah. And there's, you know, somebody walks by holding a piece of paper and you're like, oh, that's right, I forgot to do this. Or some people start going to the conference room and you're like, oh, that's right, there's a meeting. Like, and there's just a lot of subconscious and subliminal benefits that exist in your environment. And when you're removed from that environment, it's your responsibility to manage those yourself. So my measurements that I tell people are that you need to be in control of your own time, your own tasks, and your own energy. And in so doing, that means you have to do a lot more critical thinking and problem solving. So if you're feeling isolated, and we're seeing this everywhere, right? Isolation is the big scare of remote work. And it's, I can't help but laugh and be a little bit insensitive because they're like, oh, I feel isolated. Woe is me. And it's like, cool. How are you going to solve that? Like that's what the life of a remote worker is all about, is being able to think critically and solve problems independently because you don't have people around you.
Right.
So it's like, okay, how are you going to solve that problem? Are you going to tell your boss and maybe you guys can build a communication channel? Are you feeling cut off from resources? Maybe you need access to a folder that you don't have access to. Are you feeling socially isolated? Maybe you should join a yoga class or go play badminton or something. Like, solve the problem. Be willing to solve the problem. So, yeah, I think that that's really, really critical, that we are self-managers in the fact of not just being aware of ourselves, but also willing to solve the problems ourselves as well. And in so doing, most of the trouble that we have as remote workers goes away because we build a solution.
Huh. So this, so basically it's kind of like, even though companies can help you to somewhat create something or a structure around the company culture or processes, but you feel like it still most of the time goes back to an individual level, that you need to be able to solve your own problem. That's the first step, right?
And and I think it's both. Like, that's the really important part, is that it is both the employer and the worker. That's a big problem that we run into, is that each party is assuming that the other one is going to be responsible. So the worker saying, well, it's my boss's job to provide this for me. And the boss is saying, hey, they wanted to work offsite. It's their responsibility to provide this. So the key in between both of those is to establish expectations and to prevent the misunderstanding or the unfulfillment of expectations. That's why policies are retracted, is because they're saying, oh, they're not doing what I expected them to. But it's like, well, did you ever tell them that you expected that? So they go off site and they say, you know, like, I'm going to pick up my kid at 3 o'clock. No big deal. I work remotely. But then the boss is thinking, no, I expect you to be available between the hours of 9 to 5, but that was never articulated. Then therefore we have a problem. So that's, again, at the risk of being redundant, that's again why we really emphasize the importance of remote work policies, is because it clarifies those expectations so much. It's not just a legal document. In fact, a lot of times I joke that I'm more of a therapist than a consultant, because those are the conversations that I facilitate between the manager and the worker. Is, okay, you expect them to be available between 9 to 5, but you expect flexibility around the hours between, you know, 3 and 4. How do we meet in the middle? What does that look like? And because a remote work policy is not one size fits all, it's a unique set of standards and requirements for each business.
Right. So it also feels like it emphasizes the importance of documentation, right? Of just writing things down. So how would you, let's say if there's a remote startup that just kind of growing, like they're probably like 5 people, 10 people, and everyone works remotely, it's kind of okay, right? And then they go to 30 people or 50 people, and then everything's kind of messed up, you know, documentation especially. So other than hiring you, how would you advise them to at least, how would you advise them go about documenting stuff? Is there some kind of rules or best practices?
Yeah, so that's why it's so critical to get your infrastructure in place and your protocols in place while you're small, because it is easy for chaos to exist when you're small. When you have a team of five people, it doesn't matter if something's written down, and so that you think, whatever, it doesn't matter. And if somebody does go out on a limb and write something down, it's like, well, that was, you know, over above and beyond, right? Like, show off. That's unnecessary. You're right. It is absolutely unnecessary at that level. However, as you scale, it becomes more and more and more necessary. So my biggest advice is to create those correct channels and infrastructures and resources while you're small. Get in the habit of using them while it's easy, and then it's easy to add people into that as needed. So always build we're always building our products to scale, but we're not building our infrastructures to scale, especially our virtual infrastructures. And so if we don't do that, we're going to have massive growing pains. So yeah, that would be my number one piece of advice.
That's a challenge, isn't it? Like, when you're five people, you really don't want to, you just want to, you know, work on the product or the marketing or the sales side. Like, documentation is probably the last thing on your mind. Like, yeah, this can't wait. So it's like you need to, but you need to have the good habits, right? I interviewed a Liam Martin.
Yeah.
You've talked to Liam before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you talked? So he has this rule of thumb, which is, I think, super useful. It's a three strikes kind of thing. So the first time you do something, don't document it. And the second time you do something, start thinking about how would you document it. And the third time you do the same thing, then you need to start documenting it. So I think that's a good rule. If you're like five or six people, you really just need to start doing that, especially if you plan to grow, right? Especially if you do have a plan to scale to like 50, right. 60 people.
And it gives your company and your business a sense of place, because physical businesses are built with, you know, bricks and mortar and concrete and file folders, right?
Yeah.
But virtual businesses are built with software and processes. And so if you just invite somebody into just a document, that's not an employment experience, and they're going to get lost, and they're going to say, well, what am I doing here? And is this a real job and whatever? But if you can show a sense of virtual presence with a platform and with protocols and, you know, directories, and like create this sense of place and direction in your business, then that makes them feel like they're a part of something. And that really helps with the isolation. I'm not just a person sitting in my living room working on a Google Doc, but I'm a member of this team and this company and this culture, and there's people around me, even though I can't see them. And there's people that are available in case I have questions, and there's resources. I know where all of the resources are that I can tap into if I need, you know, a tool for a certain project. Like, it gives them that sense of belonging in place that we're missing by not going to an office.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I like the way you frame it. Like, you basically just make it something, it's like creating a building for the whole office. You need to frame it that way, so it's become less boring, I guess.
And especially in the tech world, right? We're so married to the onboarding process. Like, you have to have your onboarding right next to somebody. And it's like, well, yes, that is helpful, but in the case that we need it to be virtual, how can you create that same sense of protection and that same sense of safety and security and mentorship and guidance and belonging with a virtual interaction? And again, mm-hmm. like, it takes some creativity and some innovation, but all of those processes can be transitioned. We can translate physical business into virtual business with intention and with assistance from people that have done it before.
What are your favorite software or tools for a company to create this kind of virtual infrastructure, so to speak?
Yeah. So you have to remember, I went remote when the only thing we had was email. We did not have Slack.
Wow.
We did not have Asana. You know, we had email. We didn't have video calls. We didn't have anything. And so for me personally, it is not so much about the tool. It's about how you're using the tools, because we are totally. Remote work is booming, and we're going to see more and more and more and more tools every single day. So we can't get married to a specific tool. There are tools that come out that you're like, thank goodness. Like, what did I do before this? Like, it's so helpful, right? But we can't get married to the tool. We need to strategize how we use the tool. So back in the day, at the risk of sounding like I'm 90 years old, back in the day, email, yeah, it was a mess, but there was a few little things that we did in email to make sure that it stayed clean and it wasn't overwhelming and we didn't have these long threads go back and forth. And it's the same thing with your teams. Like, okay, a tool is a tool. A paintbrush is a tool. But depending on how you are trained to use the paintbrush, it's going to produce different results. Same thing with your Slack, same thing with your video conferences and your meetings, same thing with you know, GitLab and everything. Like, it just depends on how you are using this. So communicate as a team, develop some good, clean processes, and you're going to see really good results. And keep it simple too. I mean, I think that there's nothing that a communication channel and a good regular stand-up can't solve. Like, it doesn't matter if that's on text and an in-person meeting, or if you are, you know, it's Slack and a daily video call or whatever. Like, communication channel, regular check-in, that should be the core of everything, I think.
Awesome. Yeah, so Laurel, I can't continue talking to you for hours, but I know that we're running out of time. So how can listeners find you online?
Yeah, social media is probably the easiest. I'm most active on LinkedIn and Twitter. I'm the only Laurel Farr that I know of, so it's pretty easy yeah. to find me if you know how to spell my name. And you're always welcome to go to my personal website, which is laurelfarr.com, or professional website, which is distributeconsulting.com.
Awesome. And for listeners, if anyone is listening to this, like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, don't forget to check out Laurel's writing, mostly on Forbes and other places. Also on her website, you can find everything there. And yeah, Laurel, thank you so much for your time. I learned a lot. I learned a lot of new things. And yes, thank you.
Thank you, Toby. It was so nice to meet you and to be here. It was a great conversation.
Great. Awesome.